Nadine was so upset she fainted.
I cried, Fran said. I bawled until it seemed I'd never stop. I just had my mind made up that when we got there, someone would welcome us in and say, "Hi, step inside. Delousing on the right, cafeteria's on your left." She shook her head. That seems so silly now. I was not dismayed. Dauntless Harold had been there before me, left his sign, and gone on. I felt like a tenderfoot Easterner following that Indian from the Pathfinder. His view of Harold both fascinated and amazed her. Hadn't Stu really been leading the party by the time they left Vermont and struck out for Nebraska? She couldn't honestly remember. By then they had all been preoccupied with the dreams. Larry was reminding her of things she had forgotten, or worse, taken for granted. Harold risking his life to put that sign on the barn, it had seemed like a foolish risk to her, but it had done some good after all. And getting gas from that underground tank. It had apparently been a major operation for Larry, but Harold had seemed to take it purely as a matter of course. It made her feel small and made her feel guilty. They all more or less assumed that Harold was nothing but a grinning supernumerary. But Harold had turned quite a few tricks in the last 6 weeks. Had she been so much in love with Stu that it took this total stranger to point out some home truths about Harold? What made the feeling even more uncomfortable was the fact that once he had gotten his feet under him, Harold had been completely adult about herself and Stuart. Larry said, "So here's another neat sign, complete with route numbers at Stovington, right? And fluttering in the grass next to it, another payday candy wrapper. I felt like instead of following broken sticks and bent grasses, I was following Harold's trail of chocolate paydays. Well, we didn't follow your route the whole way. We bent north near Gary, Indiana, because that was one hell of a fire, still burning in places. It looked like every damn oil tank in the city went up. Anyhow, we picked up the judge on the detour, stopped by Hemingford home. We knew she was gone by then, the dreams, you know, but we all wanted to see that place just the same. The corn, the tire swing, you know what I mean?" "Yes," Franny said quietly. "Yes, I do. And all the time, I'm going crazy, thinking that something is going to happen. We're going to get attacked by a motorcycle gang or something. Run out of water, I don't know. There used to be a book my mom had. She got it from her grandmother or something. In His Steps, that was the name of it. And there were all these little stories about guys with horrible problems. Ethical problems, most of them. And the guy who wrote the book said that to solve the problems, all you had to do was ask, 'What would Jesus do?' It always cleared the trouble right up. You know what I think? It's a Zen question. Not really a question at all, but a way to clear your mind. Like saying Om and looking at the tip of your nose." Fran smiled. She knew what her mother would have said about something like that. "So when I really started to get wound up, Lucy, that's my girl, did I tell you? Lucy would say, 'Hurry up, Larry, ask the question.'" "What would Jesus do?" Fran said, amused. "No. What would Harold do?" Larry answered seriously. Fran was nearly dumbfounded. She could not help wishing to be around when Larry actually met Harold. Whatever in the world would his reaction be? "We camped in this farmyard one night, and we really were almost out of water. The place had a well, but no way of drawing it up, naturally, because the power was off and the pump wouldn't work. And Leo kept walking by and saying, 'Firsty, Larry, pretty firsty now.' And he was driving me bug shit. I could feel myself tightening up, and the next time he came by, I probably would have hit him. Nice guy, huh? Getting ready to hit a disturbed child. But a person can't change all at once. I've had plenty of time to work that out for myself." "You brought them all across from Maine intact," Franny said. "One of ours died. His appendix burst. Stu tried to operate on him, but it was no good. All in all, Larry, I'd say you did pretty well." "Harold and I did pretty well," he corrected. "Anyway, Lucy said, 'Quick, Larry, ask the question.' So I did. There was a windmill on the place that ran water up to the barn. It was turning pretty good, but there wasn't any water coming out of the barn faucets either. So I opened the big case at the foot of the windmill, where all the machinery was, and I saw that the main drive shaft had popped out of its hole. I got it back in, and bingo, all the water you could want, cold and tasty, thanks to Harold."
"Well, thanks to you. Harold wasn't really there, Larry."
"Well, he was in my head. And now I'm here, and I brought him the wine and the candy bars. He looked at her sideways. You know, I kind of thought he might be your man. She shook her head and looked down at her clasped fingers.
No, he... not Harold.
He didn't say anything for a long time, but she felt him looking at her. At last he said, Okay, how have I got it wrong? About Harold? She stood up.
I ought to go in now. It's been nice to meet you, Larry. Come by tomorrow and meet Stu. Bring your Lucy if she's not busy.
What is it about him? He insisted, standing with her.
Oh, I don't know, she said thickly.
Suddenly the tears were very close.
You make me feel as if I've treated Harold very shabbily, and I don't know why or how I did it. Can I be blamed for not loving him the way I do Stu? Is that supposed to be my fault?
No, of course not. Larry looked taken aback.
Listen, I'm sorry I barged in on you. I'll go.
He's changed, Franny burst out. I don't know how or why, and sometimes I think it might be for the better, but I don't really know, and sometimes I'm afraid.
Afraid of Harold?
She didn't answer, only looked down at her feet. She thought she had already said too much.
You were going to tell me how I could get there, he asked gently.
It's easy. Just go straight out Arapahoe until you come to the little park, the Eben G. Fine Park, I think it is. The park's on the right. Harold's little house is on the left, just across from it.
All right, thanks. Meeting you was a pleasure, Fran, busted vase and all.
She smiled, but it was perfunctory. All of the dizzy good humor had gone out of the evening. Larry raised the bottle of wine and offered his slanted little smile.
And if you see him before I do, keep a secret, huh?
Sure.
Night, Franny.
He walked back the way he had come. She watched him out of sight, then went upstairs and slipped into bed next to Stu, who was still out like a light.
Harold, she thought, pulling the covers up to her chin. How was she supposed to tell this Larry, who seemed so nice in his strangely lost way, but weren't they all lost now? That Harold Lauder was fat and juvenile and lost himself. Was she supposed to tell him that one day not so long ago she had happened upon wise Harold, resourceful Harold, what would Jesus do Harold, mowing the back lawn in his bathing suit and weeping? Was she supposed to tell him that the sometimes sulky, often frightened Harold that had come to Boulder from a gunquit had turned into a stout politician, a backslapper, a hail fellow well-met type of a guy who nonetheless looked at you with the flat and unsmiling eyes of a Gila monster? She thought her wait for sleep might be very long tonight. Harold had fallen hopelessly in love with her, and she had fallen hopelessly in love with Stu Redman, and it certainly was a tough old world. And now, every time I see Harold, I get such a case of the creeps. Even though he looks like he's lost 10 pounds or so, and he doesn't have quite so many pimples, I get the... Her breath caught audibly in her throat, and she sat up on her elbows, eyes wide in the dark. Something had moved inside her. Her hands went to the slight swelling of her middle. Surely it was too early. It had only been her imagination, except it hadn't been. She lay back down slowly, her heart beating hard. She almost woke Stu up, and then didn't. If only he had put the baby inside her, instead of Jess. If he had, she would have awakened him and shared the moment with him. The next baby she would. If there was a next baby, of course. And then the movement came again, so slight it might only have been gas. Except she knew better. It was the baby. And the baby was alive. Oh, glory, she murmured to herself, and lay back.
Larry Underwood and Harold Lauder were forgotten. Everything that had happened to her since her mother had fallen ill was forgotten. She waited for it to move again, listening for that presence inside herself, and fell asleep listening. Her baby was alive. Harold sat in a chair on the lawn of the little house he had picked out for himself, looking up at the sky and thinking of an old rock and roll song. He hated rock, but he could remember this one almost line for line,
and even the name of the group that had sung it, Kathy Young and the Innocents. The lead singer, songstress, whatever, had a high, yearning, reedy voice that had somehow caught his full attention. A golden goodie, the DJs called it. A blast from the past, a platter that matters. The girl singing lead sounded 16 years old, pallid, blonde, and plain. She sounded as if she might be singing to a picture that spent most of its time buried in a dresser drawer, a picture that was taken out only late at night when everyone else in the house was asleep. She sounded hopeless. The picture she sang to had perhaps been clipped from her big sister's yearbook, a picture of the local big jock, captain of the football team and president of the student council. The big jock would be slipping it to the head cheerleader on some deserted lover's lane, while far away in suburbia this plain girl with no breasts and a pimple in the corner of her mouth sang, "A thousand stars in the sky make me realize you are the one love that I'll adore. Tell me you love me. Tell me you're mine, all mine." There were a lot more than 1,000 stars in his sky tonight, but they weren't lover's stars. No soft call of Milky Way here. Here, a mile above sea level, they were as sharp and cruel as a billion holes in black velvet, stabs from God's ice pick. They were haters' stars, and because they were, Harold felt well qualified to wish on them. Wish I may, wish I might, have the wish I wish tonight. Drop dead, folks. He sat silently with his head cocked back, a brooding astronomer. Harold's hair was longer than ever, but it was no longer dirty and clotted and tangled. He no longer smelled like a shoot-off in a haymow. Even his blemishes were clearing up, now that he had laid off the candy, and with the hard work and all the walking he was losing some weight. He was starting to look pretty good. There had been times in the last few weeks when he had strode past some reflective surface, only to glance back over his shoulder, startled, as if he had caught a glimpse of a total stranger. He shifted in his chair. There was a book in his lap, a tall volume with a marbled blue binding and imitation leather covers. He kept it hidden under a loose hearthstone in the house when he was away. If anyone found the book, that would be the end of him in Boulder. There was one word stamped in gold leaf on the book's cover, and the word was ledger. It was the journal he had started after reading Fran's diary. Already he had filled the first 60 pages with his close margin-to-margin handwriting. There were no paragraphs, only a solid block of writing, an outpouring of hate like pus from a skin abscess. He hadn't thought he had so much hate in him. It seemed he should have exhausted the flow by now, yet it seemed he had only tapped it. It was like that old joke. Why was the ground all white after Custer's last stand? Because the Indians kept coming and coming and... And why did he hate? He sat up straight, as if the question had come from the outside. It was a hard question to answer, except maybe to a few, a chosen few. Hadn't Einstein said there were only 6 people in the world who understood all the implications of E equals MC squared? What about the equation inside his own skull? The relativity of Harold? The speed of blight? Oh, he could fill twice as many pages as he had already written about that, becoming more obscure, more arcane, until he finally became lost in the clockwork of himself and still nowhere near the mainspring at all. He was perhaps raping himself. Was that it? It was close, anyway. An obscene and ongoing act of buggery. The Indians just kept on coming and coming. He would be leaving Boulder soon, a month or two, no more, when he finally settled on a method of settling his scores. Then he would head out west. And when he got there, he would open his mouth and spill his guts about this place. He would tell them what went on at the public meetings, and much more important, what went on at the private meetings. He was sure to be on the Free Zone Committee. He would be welcomed, and he would be well rewarded by the fellow in charge over there. Not by an end to hate, but by the perfect vehicle for it. A hate Cadillac. A fear Dorado, long and darkly shining. He would climb into it, and it would bear him and his hate down on them. He and Flagg would kick this miserable settlement apart like an anthill. But first he would settle with Redman, who had lied to him and stolen his woman. Yes, Harold, but why do you hate? No, there was no satisfactory answer to that, only a kind of endorsement for the hate itself. Was it even a fair question? He thought not. You might as well ask a woman why she gave birth to a defective baby. There had been a time, an hour, or an instant, when he had contemplated jettisoning the hate. That had been after he had finished reading Fran's diary and had discovered she was irrevocably committed to Stu Redman. That sudden knowledge had acted upon him the way a dash of cold water acts on a slug, causing it to contract into a tight little ball instead of a spread-out, loosely questing organism. In that hour or instant, he became aware that he could simply accept what was, and that knowledge had both exhilarated and terrified him. For that space of time, he knew he could turn himself into a new person, a fresh Harold Lauder, cloned from the old one by the sharp intervening knife of the superflu epidemic. He sensed more clearly than any of the others that that was what the Boulder Free Zone was all about. People were not the same as they had been. This small-town society was like no other in American pre-plague society. They didn't see it because they didn't stand outside the boundaries as he did. Men and women were living together with no apparent desire to reinstitute the ceremony of marriage. Whole groups of people were living together in small sub-communities like communes. There wasn't much fighting. People seemed to be getting along. And strangest of all, none of them seemed to be questioning the profound theological implications of the dreams, and of the plague itself. Boulder itself was a cloned society, a tabula so rasa that it could not sense its own novel beauty. Harold sensed it, and hated it. Far away over the mountains was another cloned creature, a cutting from the dark malignancy, a single wild cell taken from the dying corpus of the old body politic, a lone representative of the carcinoma that had been eating the old society alive. One single cell, but it had already begun to reproduce itself and spawn other wild cells. For society, it would be the old struggle, the effort of healthy tissue to reject the malignant incursion. But for each individual cell, there was the old, old question, the one that went back to the garden. Did you eat the apple or leave it alone? Over there in the West, they were already eating them a mess of apple pie and apple cobbler. The assassins of Eden were there, the dark fusiliers. And he himself, when faced with the knowledge that he was free to accept what was, had rejected the new opportunity. To seize it would have been to murder himself. The ghost of every humiliation he had ever suffered cried out against it. His murdered dreams and ambitions came back to eldritch life and asked if he could forget them so easily. And in the new free zone society, he could only be Harold Lauder. Over there, he could be a prince. The malignancy drew him. It was a dark carnival. Ferris wheels with their lights out revolving above a black landscape, a never-ending sideshow filled with freaks like himself, and in the main tent the lions ate the spectators. What called to him was this discordant music of chaos. He opened his journal and by starlight wrote firmly, August 12, 1990, early morning. It is said that the two great human sins are pride and hate. Are they? I like to think of them as the two great virtues. To give away pride and hate is to say you will change for the good of the world. To embrace them, to vent them, is more noble. That is to say that the world must change for the good of you. I am on a great adventure. Harold Emery Lauder. He closed the book. He went into the house, put the book in its hole in the hearth, and carefully replaced the hearthstone. He went into the bathroom, set his Coleman lamp on the sink so that it illuminated the mirror, and for the next 15 minutes he practiced smiling. He was getting very good at it. Chapter 51 Ralph's posters announcing the August 18th meeting went up all over Boulder. There was a great deal of excited conversation, most of it having to do with the good and bad qualities of the 7-person ad hoc committee. Mother Abigail went to bed exhausted before the light was even gone from the sky. The day had been a steady stream of callers, all of them wanting to know what her opinion was. She allowed as how she thought most of the choices for the committee were pretty good. The people were anxious to know if she would serve on a more permanent committee, if one should be formed at the big meeting. She replied that that would be a spot too tiring, but she sure would give a committee of elected representatives whatever help she could, if people wanted her to help out. She was assured again and again that any permanent committee that refused her help would be turned out en masse, and that right early. Mother Abigail went to bed tired but satisfied. So did Nick Andros that night. In one day, by virtue of a single poster turned out on a hand-crank mimeograph machine, the Free Zone had been transformed from a loose group of refugees into potential voters. They liked it. It gave them the sense of a place to stand after a long period of freefall. That afternoon, Ralph drove him out to the power plant. He, Ralph, and Stu agreed to hold a preliminary meeting at Stu and Franny's place the day after next. It would give all seven of them another 2 days to listen to what people were saying. Nick smiled and cupped his own useless ears.
"Lip reading's even better," Stu said.
"You know, Nick, I'm starting to think we're really going to get somewhere with those blown motors. That Brad Kitchener's a regular bear for work. If we had 10 like him, we'd have this whole town running perfect by the 1st of September." Nick gave him a thumb and forefinger circle, and they walked inside together. That afternoon, Larry Underwood and Leo Rockway walked west on Arapaho Street toward Harold's house. Larry was wearing the knapsack he had worn all the way across the country, but all that was in it now was the bottle of wine and a half-dozen paydays. Lucy was out with a party of half a dozen people who had taken two wrecking trucks and were beginning to clear the streets and roads in and around Boulder of stalled vehicles. Trouble was, they were working on their own. It was a sporadic operation that only ran when a few people felt like getting together and doing it. A wrecking bee instead of a quilting bee, Larry thought, and his eye caught one of the posters headed Mass Meeting, this one nailed to a telephone pole. Maybe that would be the answer. Hell, people around here wanted to work. What they needed was somebody to coordinate things and tell them what to do. He thought that, most of all, they wanted to wipe away the evidence of what had happened here this early summer. And could it be late summer already? The way you would use an eraser to wipe dirty words off a blackboard. Maybe we can't do it from one end of America to the other, Larry thought. But we should be able to do it here in Boulder before snow flies, if Mother Nature cooperates. A tinkle of glass made him turn. Leo had lobbed a large stone from someone's rock garden through the rear window of an old Ford. A bumper sticker on the back deck of the Ford's trunk read, "Get your ass up the pass, Cold Creek Canyon."
"Don't do that, Joe."
"I'm Leo." "Leo," he corrected, "don't do that." "Why not?" Leo asked complacently, and for a long time Larry couldn't think of a satisfactory answer.
"Because it makes an ugly sound," he said finally.
"Oh, okay."
They walked on. Larry put his hands in his pockets. Leo did likewise. Larry kicked a beer can. Leo swerved out of his way to kick a stone. Larry began to whistle a tune. Leo made a whispering, chuffling sound in accompaniment. Larry ruffled the kid's hair, and Leo looked up at him with those odd Chinese eyes and grinned. And Larry thought, "For Christ's sake, I'm falling in love with him. Pretty far out." They came to the park Franny had mentioned, and across from it was a greenhouse with white shutters. There was a wheelbarrow full of bricks on the cement path leading up to the front door, and next to it was a garbage can lid filled with that do-it-yourself mortar mix to which you just add water. Squatting beside it, his back to the street, was a broad-shouldered dude with his shirt off and the peeling remnants of a bad sunburn. He had a trowel in one hand. He was building a low and curving brick wall around a flower bed. Larry thought of Fran saying, "He's changed. I don't know how or why, or even if it's for the best. And sometimes I'm afraid." Then he stepped forward, saying it just the way he had planned on his long days across the country. "Harold Lauder, I presume?" Harold jerked with surprise, then turned with a brick in one hand and his mortar-dripping trowel in the other, half-raised, like a weapon. Out of the corner of his eye, Larry thought he saw Leo flinch backward. His first thought was, sure enough, Harold didn't look at all as he had imagined. His second thought had to do with the trowel. My God, is he going to let me have it with that thing? Harold's face was grimly set, his eyes narrow and dark. His hair fell in a lank wave across his sweaty forehead. His lips were pressed together and almost white. And then there was a transformation so sudden and complete that Larry was never quite able to believe afterward that he had seen that tense, unsmiling Harold, the face of a man more apt to use a trowel to wall someone up in a basement niche than to construct a garden wall around a flower bed. He smiled, a broad and harmless grin that made deep dimples at the corners of his mouth. His eyes lost their menacing cast. They were bottle green, and how could such clear and feckless eyes have seemed menacing or even dark? He stuck the trowel blade down into the mortar, chunk, wiped his hands on the hips of his jeans, and advanced with his hand out. Larry thought, my God, he's just a kid, younger than I am. If he's 18 yet, I'll eat the candles on his last birthday cake. Don't think I know you, Harold said, grinning as they shook. He had a firm grip. Larry's hand was pumped up and down exactly 3 times and let go. It reminded Larry of the time he had shaken hands with George Bush back when the old bushwhacker had been running for president. It had been at a political rally, which he had attended on the advice of his mother, given many years ago. If you can't afford a movie, go to the zoo. If you can't afford the zoo, go see a politician. But Harold's grin was contagious, and Larry grinned back. Kid or not, politician's handshake or not, the grin impressed him as completely genuine. And after all this time, after all those candy wrappers, here was Harold Lauder in the flesh. No, you don't, Larry said, but I'm acquainted with you. Is that so? Harold exclaimed, and his grin escalated. If it got any broader, Larry thought with amusement, the ends would meet around at the back of his skull, and the top 2/3 of his head would just topple off. I followed you across the country from Maine, Larry said. No fooling! You did, really? Really did. He unslung his pack sack. Here, I've got some stuff for you. He took out the bottle of Bordeaux and put it in Harold's hand. Say, you shouldn't have, Harold said, looking at the bottle with some astonishment. 1947? A good year, Larry said. And these. He put nearly half a dozen paydays in Harold's other hand. One of them slipped through his fingers and onto the grass. Harold bent to pick it up, and as he did, Larry caught a glimpse of that earlier expression. Then Harold bobbed back up, smiling. How did you know? I followed your signs and your candy wrappers. Well, I be go to hell. Come on in the house. We ought to have a jaw, as my dad was fond of saying. Would your boy drink a Coke? Sure. Wouldn't you He looked around, but Leo was no longer beside him. He was all the way back on the sidewalk and looking down at some cracks in the pavement as if they were of great interest to him. Hey, Leo, want a Coke? Leo muttered something Larry couldn't hear. Talk up, he said, irritated. What did God give you a voice for? I asked you if you wanted a Coke. Barely audible, Leo said, I think I'll go see if Nadine Mom's back. What the hell we just got here? I want to go back, Leo said, looking up from the cement. The sun flashed too strongly back from his eyes, and Larry thought, what in God's name is this? He's almost crying. Just a sec, he said to Harold. Sure, Harold said, grinning. Sometimes kids are shy, I was. Larry walked over to Leo and hunkered down so they would be at eye level. What's the matter, kiddo? I just want to go back, Leo said, not meeting his gaze. I want Nadine, Mom. Well, you... He paused helplessly. Want to go back? He looked up briefly at Larry. His eyes flickered over Larry's shoulder toward where Harold stood in the middle of his lawn, then down at the cement again. Please. You don't like Harold? I don't know. He's all right. I just want to go back. Larry sighed. Can you find your way? Sure. Okay, but I sure wish you'd come in and have a Coke with us.
I've been waiting to meet Harold a long time. You know that, don't you?
Yes. And we could walk back together.
I'm not going in that house,
Leo hissed. And for a moment he was Joe again, the eyes going blank and savage.
Okay, Larry said hastily.
He stood up.
Go straight home. I'll check to see if you did, and stay out of the street.
I will.
And suddenly Leo blurted in that small, hissing whisper,
Why don't you come back with me? Right now. We'll go together. Please, Larry. Okay?
Jeez, Leo, what—
Never mind,
Leo said. And before Larry could say anything more, Leo was hurrying away. Larry stood watching him until he was out of sight. Then he turned back to Harold with a troubled frown.
Say, that's all right, Harold said. Kids are funny.
Well, that one sure is, but I guess he's got a right. He's been through a lot.
I'll bet he has, Harold replied.
And for just an instant, Larry felt distrust. Felt that Harold's quick sympathy for a boy he had never met was as ersatz as powdered eggs.
Well, come in, Harold said. You know, you're just about my first company. Franny and Stu have been out a few times, but they hardly count.
His grin became a smile, a slightly sad smile, and Larry felt sudden pity for this boy. Because a boy was all he was, really. He was lonely, and here stood Larry, same old Larry, never a good word for anyone, judging him on vapors. It wasn't fair. It was time for him to stop being so goddamn mistrustful.
Glad to, he answered.
The living room was small but comfortable.
I'm going to put in some new furniture when I get around to it, Harold said. Modern, chrome and leather. As the commercial says, fuck the budget, I've got MasterCard.
Larry laughed heartily.
There's some good glasses in the basement, I'll just get them. I think I'll pass on the candy bars, if that's all right with you. I'm off the sweets, trying to lose weight, but we've got to try the wine. This is a special occasion. You came all the way across the country from Maine behind us, huh? And following our signs. That's really something. You'll have to tell me all about it. Meanwhile, try that green chair. It's the best of a bad lot.
Larry had one final doubtful thought during this outpouring. He even talks like a politician, smooth and quick and glib. Harold left, and Larry sat down in the green chair. He heard a door open, and then Harold's heavy tread descending a flight of stairs. He looked around.
Nope, not one of the world's great living rooms, but with a shag rug and some nice modern furniture, it might be fine.
The best feature was the stone fireplace and chimney. Lovely work, carefully done by hand. But there was one loose stone on the hearth. It looked to Larry as if it had come out and had been put back a little carelessly. Leaving it like that would be like leaving one piece out of the jigsaw puzzle or a picture hanging crooked on the wall. He got up and picked the stone out of the hearth. Harold was still rummaging around downstairs. Larry was about to put it back in when he saw there was a book down in the hole, its front now lightly powdered with rock dust, not enough to obscure the single word stamped there in gold leaf. Ledger. Feeling slightly ashamed, as if he had been prying intentionally, he put the rock back in place just as Harold's footfalls began to ascend the stairs again. This time the fit was perfect, and when Harold came back into the living room with a balloon glass in each hand, Larry was seated in the green chair again.
I took a minute to rinse them out in the downstairs sink, Harold said. They were a bit dusty.
They look fine, Larry said.
Look, I can't swear that Bordeaux hasn't gone over. We might be helping ourselves to vinegar.
Nothing ventured, Harold said, grinning. Nothing gained.
That grin made him feel uncomfortable, and Larry suddenly found himself thinking about the ledger. Was it Harold's, or had it belonged to the house's previous owner? And if it was Harold's, what in the world might be written in there?
They cracked the bottle of Bordeaux and found, to their mutual pleasure, that it was just fine. Half an hour later, they were both pleasantly squiffed, Harold a little more so than Larry. Even so, Harold's grin remained, broadened, in fact.
His tongue loosened a bit by wine, Larry said,
Those posters, the big meeting on the 18th. How come you didn't get on that committee, Harold? I would have thought a guy like you would have been a natural. Harold's smile became large, beatific. Well, I'm awfully young. I suppose they thought I didn't have experience enough. I think it's a goddamn shame. But did he? The grin. The dark, barely glimpsed expression of suspicion. Did he? He didn't know. Well, who knows what lies in the future, Harold said, grinning broadly. Every dog has its day. Larry left around 5 o'clock. His parting from Harold was friendly. Harold shook his hand, grinned, told him to come back often. But Larry had somehow gotten the feeling that Harold could give a shit if he never came back. He walked slowly down the cement path to the sidewalk and turned it to wave, but Harold had already gone back inside. The door was shut. It had been very cool in the house because the Venetian blinds were drawn, and inside that had seemed all right. But standing outside, it occurred to him suddenly that it was the only house he'd been inside in Boulder where the blinds and curtains were drawn. But of course, he thought, there were still plenty of houses in Boulder where the shades were drawn. They were the houses of the dead. When they got sick, they had drawn their curtains against the world. They had drawn them and died in privacy, like any animal in its last extremity prefers to do. The living, maybe in subconscious acknowledgement of that fact of death, threw their shutters and their curtains wide. He had a slight headache from the wine, and he tried to tell himself that the chill he felt came from that, part of a little hangover, righteous punishment administered for guzzling good wine as if it was cheap Muscatel. But that wouldn't quite get it. No, it wouldn't. He stared up and down the street and thought, thank God for tunnel vision. Thank God for selective perception. Because without it, we might as well all be in a Lovecraft story. His thoughts became confused. He became suddenly convinced that Harold was peeping at him from between the slats of his blinds, his hands opening and closing in a strangler's grip, his grin turned into a leer of hatred. Every dog has its day. At the same time, he was remembering the night in Bennington, sleeping on the stage of the bandshell, waking up to the horrible feeling that someone was there, then hearing, or only dreaming it, the dusty sound of boot heels moving off to the west. Stop it. Stop freaking yourself out. Boot Hill, his mind free associated. Christ's sake, just stop it. Wish I'd never thought about the dead people behind all those closed blinds and pulled drapes and shut curtains, in the dark, like in the tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel. Christ, what if they all started to move, to stir around? Holy God, cut it out! And suddenly he found himself thinking of a trip to the Bronx Zoo with his mother when he had been small. They had gone into the monkey house, and the smell in there had hit him like a physical thing, a fist driven not just at his nose, but into it. He had turned to bolt out of there, but his mother had stopped him. Just breathe normal, Larry, she had said. In 5 minutes you won't notice that nasty smell at all. So he had stayed, not believing her, just fighting not to puke. Even at the age of 7, he had hated to puke worse than anything. And it turned out she was right. When he looked down at his watch the next time, he saw that they had been in the monkey house for 30 minutes. And he couldn't understand why the ladies who came in the door were suddenly clapping their hands over their noses and looking disgusted. He said as much to his mother, and Alice Underwood had laughed. Oh, it still smells bad, all right. Just not to you. How come, Mommy? I don't know. Everybody can do it. Now just say to yourself, I'm going to smell how the monkey house really is again, and take a deep breath. So he did, and the stink was there. The stink was even bigger and badder than it had been when they first came in, and his hot dogs and cherry pie started to come up on him again in one big sickening whipped bubble, and he had charged for the door and the fresh air beyond it and managed, barely, to hold everything down. That's selective perception, he thought now, and she knew what it was even if she didn't know what it's called. This thought had no more than completed itself in his mind before he heard his mother's voice saying, "Just say to yourself, I'm going to smell how Boulder really smells again." And he was smelling it,
Just like that, he was smelling it.
He was smelling what was behind all the closed doors and drawn shades and pulled blinds. He was smelling the slow corruption that was going on even in this place which had died almost empty. He walked faster, not running, but getting closer and closer to it, smelling that fruity, rich reek which he, and everyone else, had stopped consciously smelling because it was everywhere. It was everything. It was coloring their thoughts. And you didn't pull your shades even if you were making love, because the dead lie behind drawn shades, and the living still want to look out on the world. It wanted to come up on him. Not hot dogs and cherry pie now, but wine and a payday candy bar. Because this was one monkey house he was never going to be able to get out of, not unless he moved to an island where no one had ever lived, and even though he still hated to puke worse than anything, he was going to now. "Larry, are you okay?" He was so startled that a little noise, "Yike!" squeaked out of his throat, and he jumped. It was Leo, sitting on the curb about 3 blocks down from Harold's. He had a ping-pong ball and was bouncing it up and down on the pavement. "What are you doing here?" Larry asked. His heartbeat was slowly returning to normal. "I wanted to walk home with you," Leo said diffidently, "but I didn't want to go into that guy's house."
"Why not?" Larry asked.
He sat down on the curb beside Leo. Leo shrugged and turned his eyes back to the ping-pong ball. It made a small whack, whack sound as it struck the pavement and bounced back up to his hand.
"I don't know."
"Leo?"
"What?"
"This is very important to me, because I like Harold, and don't like him. I feel two ways about him."
"Have you ever felt two ways about a person?"
"I only feel one way about him."
Whack, whack.
"How?"
"Scared," Leo said simply. "Can we go home and see my Nadine mom and my Lucy mom?"
"Sure." They continued down Arapaho for a while without speaking, Leo still bouncing the ping-pong ball and catching it deftly.
"Sorry you had to wait so long," Larry said.
"Aw, that's okay."
"No, really, if I'd known, I would have hurried up."
"I had something to do. I found this on a guy's lawn. It's a pong-ping ball."
"Ping-pong," Larry corrected absently.
"Why do you think Harold would keep his shades down?"
"So nobody can see in, I guess," Leo said. "So he can do secret things. It's like the dead people, isn't it?"
Whack, whack. They walked on, reached the corner of Broadway, and turned south. They saw other people on the streets now, women looking in windows at dresses, a man with a pickaxe returning from somewhere, another man casually sorting through fishing tackle in the broken display window of a sporting goods store. Larry saw Dick Volman from his party biking in the other direction. He waved at Larry and Leo. They waved back.
"Secret things," Larry mused aloud, not really trying to draw the boy out anymore.
"Maybe he's praying to the dark man," Leo said casually. And Larry jerked as if brushed by a live wire. Leo didn't notice. He was double-bouncing his ping-pong ball, first off the sidewalk and then catching it on the rebound from the brick wall they were passing. Whack-whap.
"Do you really think so?" Larry asked, making an effort to sound casual.
"I don't know, but he's not like us. He smiles a lot. But I think there might be worms inside him making him smile. Big white worms eating up his brain, like maggots."
Leo's eyes, dark, remote, and Chinese, suddenly cleared. He smiled.
"Look, there's Dana. I like her. Hey, Dana," he yelled, waving. "Got any gum?"
Dana, who had been oiling the sprocket of a spidery thin 10-speed bike, turned and smiled. She reached into her shirt pocket and spread out 5 sticks of juicy fruit like a poker hand. With a happy laugh, Leo ran toward her, his long hair flying, ping-pong ball clutched in one hand, leaving Larry to stare after him. That idea of white worms behind Harold's smile. Where had gotten an idea as sophisticated and as horrible as that? The boy had been in a semi-trance.
And he wasn't the only one. How many times in the few days he had been here had Larry seen someone just stop dead on the street, looking blankly at nothing for a moment, and then go on? Things had changed. The whole range of human perception seemed to have stepped up a notch. It was scary as hell. Larry got his feet moving and walked over to where Leo and Dana were sharing out the chewing gum. That afternoon, Stu found Franny washing clothes in the small yard behind their building. She had filled a low wash tub with water, had shaken in nearly half a box of Tide, and had stirred everything with a mop handle until a sickly suds had resulted. She doubted if she was going about this in the right way, but she was damned if she was going to go to Mother Abigail and expose her ignorance. She dumped their clothes in the water, which was stone cold, then grimly jumped in and began to stomp and slosh around, like a Sicilian mashing grapes. "Your new model Maytag 5000, she thought. "The double-foot agitation method, perfect for all your bright colors, fragile under things, and..." She turned around and beheld her man, standing just inside the backyard gate, and watching with an expression of amusement. Franny stopped, a little out of breath. "Ha-ha, very funny. How long have you been there, smarty pants?" "Couple of minutes. What do you call that anyway, the mating dance of the wild wood duck?" "Again, ha-ha." She looked coolly at him. "One more crack like that and you can spend the night on the couch, or up on Flagstaff with your friend Glenn Bateman." "Say, I didn't mean—" "They're your clothes too, Mr. Stuart Redman. You may be a founding father and all that, but you still leave an occasional skid mark in your underdrawers." Stu grinned, the grin broadened, and finally he had to laugh. "That's crude, darling. Right now I don't feel particularly delicate." "Well, pop out for a minute. I need to talk to you." She was glad to, even though she would have to wash her feet before getting back in. Her heart was hurrying along, not happily but rather dolefully, like a faithful piece of machinery being misused by someone with a marked lack of good sense. If this was the way my great-great-great-grandmother had to do it, Fran thought, then maybe she was entitled to the room which eventually became my mother's precious parlor. Maybe she thought of it as hazard pay or something like that. She looked down at her feet and lower legs with some discouragement. There was still a thin sheath of gray soap suds clinging to them. She brushed at it distastefully. "When my wife hand washed," Stu said, "she used a, what do you call it, scrub board, I think. My mother had about three, I remember." "I know that," Franny said, irritated. "June Brinkmeyer and I walked over half of Boulder looking for one. We couldn't find a single one. Technology strikes again." He was smiling again. Franny put her hands on her hips. "Are you trying to piss me off, Stuart Redman?" "No'm. I was just thinking I know where I can get you a scrub board, I think. Junie, too, if she wants one." "Where?" "You let me look and see first." His smile disappeared, and he put his arms around her and his forehead on hers. "You know I appreciate you washing my clothes," he said. "And I know that a woman who is pregnant knows better than her man what she should and shouldn't be doing. But, Franny, why bother?" "Why?" She looked at him, perplexed. "Well, what are you going to wear? Do you want to go around in dirty clothes?" "Franny, the stores are full of clothes, and I'm an easy size." "What, throw out old ones just because they're dirty?" He shrugged a little uneasily. "No way, uh-uh," she said. "That's the old way, Stu, like the boxes they used to put your Big Mac in, or the no-deposit, no-return bottles. That's no way to start over." He gave her a little kiss. "All right, only next wash day it's my turn, you hear?" "Sure." She smiled a little slyly. "And how long does that last? Until I deliver?"
"Until we get the power back on," Stu said. "Then I'm going to bring you the biggest, shiniest washer you ever saw and hook it up myself."
Offer accepted. She kissed him firmly, and he kissed her back, his strong hands moving restlessly in her hair. The result was a spreading warmth, hotness. Let's not be coy. I'm hot, and he always gets me hot when he does that. That first peaked her nipples, then spread down into her lower belly.
You better stop, she said rather breathlessly, unless you plan to do more than talk.
Maybe we'll talk later.
The clothes, soaking's good for that grind in dirt, he said seriously.
She started to laugh, and he stopped her mouth with a kiss. As he lifted her, set her on her feet, and led her inside, she was struck by the warmth of the sun on her shoulders and wondered, was it ever so hot before? So strong? It's cleared up every last blemish on my back. Could it be the ultraviolet, I wonder, or the altitude? Is it this way every summer? Is it this hot? And then he was doing things to her, even on the stairs he was doing things to her, making her naked, making her hot, making her love him.
No, you sit down, he said.
But I mean it, Franny.
Stuart, they'll congeal or something. I put half a box of Tide in there.
Don't worry. So she sat down in the lawn chair in the building's shady overhang. He had set up two of them when they came back down. Stu took off his shoes and socks and rolled up his pants past the knee. As he stepped into the washtub and began gravely to stomp up and down on the clothes, she began to giggle helplessly. Stu looked over and said, "You want to spend the night on the couch?"
"No, Stuart," she said with grave repentance, and then began to giggle again, until tears ran down her cheeks and the little muscles in her stomach felt rubbery and weak. When she had some control again, she said, "For the third and last time, what did you come back to talk about?"
"Oh, yeah." He marched back and forth, and by now he had worked up quite a bed of lather. A pair of blue jeans floated to the surface, and he stomped them back down, sending a creamy squirt of soap suds onto the lawn. Franny thought, "It looks a little like..." "Oh, no, away with that. Away with that, unless you want to laugh yourself into a miscarriage."
"We've got that first ad hoc meeting tonight," Stu said. "I've got two cases of beer, cheese crackers, cheese spread, some pepperoni that should still be..."
"That's not it, Franny. Dick Ellis came by today and said he wanted off the committee."
"He did?"
She was surprised. Dick had not impressed her as the sort of man who would back away from responsibility. "He said he'd be glad to serve in any capacity as soon as we get ourselves a real doctor, but just now he can't. We had another 25 come in today, and one of them had a gangrenous leg. Came from a scratch she got crawling under a rusty barbed wire fence, apparently."
"Oh, that's bad."
"Dick saved her. Dick and that nurse that came in with Underwood. Tall, pretty girl. Lori Constable, her name is. Dick said he just would have lost the woman without her. Anyway, they took her leg off at the knee, and they're both exhausted. It took them 3 hours. Plus, they've got a little boy with convulsive fits, and Dick's driving himself crazy trying to figure out if it's epilepsy or cranial pressure of some kind, or maybe diabetes. They've had several cases of food poisoning from people eating stuff that's gone over, and he says some people are going to die of it if we don't get out a flyer real soon telling people how to pick their supplies. Well, let's see, where was I? Two broken arms, one case of the flu.
My God, did you say flu?
Ease up. It's the regular flu. Aspirin knocks down the fever, no sweat, and it doesn't come back up. No black patches on the neck either. But Dick isn't sure which antibiotics to use, if any, and he's burning the midnight oil trying to find out. Also, he's scared the flu will spread and people will panic.
Who is it?
A lady named Rona Hewitt. She walked most of the way here from Laramie, Wyoming, and Dick says she was ripe for a bug. Fran nodded. Lucky for us, this Lori Constable seems sort of stuck on Dick, even though he's about twice her age. I guess that's all right.
How big of you to give them your seal of approval, Stuart?
He smiled. Anyhow, Dick's 48 and he's got a minor heart condition. Right now he feels that he can't spread himself too thin. He's practically studying to be a doctor for the Lord's sake. He looked soberly at Fran. I can understand why that Lori fell for him. He's the closest thing to a hero we've got around here. He's just a country vet, and he's scared shitless he's going to kill someone.
and he knows there are more people coming in every day, and some of them have been banged around.
So we need one more for the committee.
Yeah, Ralph Brentner's gung-ho for this Larry Underwood guy, and from what you say, he struck you as being pretty handy.
Yes, he did. I think he'd be fine. And I met his lady today downtown. Lucy Swan, her name is. She's awfully sweet, and she thinks the world of Larry.
I guess every good woman feels that way, but, Franny, I gotta be honest with you, I don't like the way he spilled his life story to someone he just met.
I think it was just because I was with Harold from the start. I don't think he understood why I was with you instead of him.
I wonder what he made of Harold.
Ask him and see.
I guess I will.
Are you going to invite him onto the committee?
More likely than not.
He stood up.
I'd like to have that old fellow they call the judge, but he's 70, and that's too damn old.
Have you talked to him about Larry?
No, but Nick did. Nick Andros is one sharp guy, Fran. He changed a few things around on Glenn and I. Glenn was a little bent out of shape about it, but even he had to admit Nick's ideas were good ones. Anyway, the judge told Nick that Larry's just the kind of person we're looking for. He said Larry was just getting around to finding out he was good for something, and that he was going to get a lot better.
I'd call that a pretty strong recommendation.
Yes, Stu said. But I'm going to find out what he thought of Harold before I invite him along for the ride.
What is it about Harold? She asked restlessly.
Might as well ask what it is about you, Fran. You still feel responsible for him.
Do I? I don't know. But when I think about him, I still feel a little guilty. I can tell you that.
Why, because I cut in on him?
Fran, did you ever want him?
No, God, no. She almost shuddered. I lied to him once, Stu said. Well, it wasn't actually a lie. It was the day the three of us met. July 4th. I think he might have sensed what was coming even then. I said I didn't want you. How was I to know right then if I wanted you or not? There may be such a thing as love at first sight in books, but in real life... He stopped, and a slow grin spread across his face.
What are you grinning about, Stuart Redman?
I was just thinking, he said, that in real life it took me at least... He rubbed his chin consideringly. Oh, I'm going to say 4 hours.
She kissed his cheek. That's very sweet.
It's a truth. Anyway, I think he still holds what I said against me.
He never says a mean word against you, Stu, or anybody.
No, Stu agreed. He smiles. That's what I don't like.
You don't think he's plotting revenge or anything?
Stu smiled and stood up. No, not Harold. Glenn thinks the opposition party may just end up coming together around Harold. That's okay. I just hope he doesn't try to fuck up what we're doing now.
Just remember that he's scared and lonely.
And jealous.
Jealous?
She considered it, then shook her head.
I don't think so. I really don't. I've talked to him, and I think I'd know. He may be feeling rejected, though. I think he expected to be on the ad hoc committee.
That was one of Nick's unilateral... Is that the word? Decisions that we all went along with. What it came down to was that none of us quite trusted him.
In a gunkwit, she said, he was the most insufferable kid you could imagine. A lot of it was compensation for his family situation, I guess. To them it must have seemed like he had hatched from a cowbird egg or something. But after the flu he seemed to change. At least to me he did. He seemed to be trying to be, well, a man. Then he changed again, like all at once. He started to smile all the time. You couldn't really talk to him anymore. He was in himself, the way people get when they convert to religion or read. She stopped suddenly, and her eyes took on a momentary startled look that seemed very like fear.
Read what? Stu asked.
Something that changes their lives, she said. Das Kapital, Mein Kampf, or maybe just intercepted love letters.
What are you talking about?
Hmm? She looked around at him as if startled out of a deep daydream. Then she smiled. Nothing.
weren't you going to go see Larry Underwood?
Sure, if you're okay.
I'm better than okay. I'm